All right, so it's now time to ask Thomas Holderness come to give his speech about a cog in the machine.
So, this is awesome. And how's the audio? Good? Yeah. So, thanks. Yeah, my name is Thomas. I work at AddressCloud, and I lead the technical development of our solution. And I'm here to talk today about cloud-optimized geotiffs. And how we're using them, which is a little bit different to some of the other use cases that we've seen. And so great to see so many talks about cogs at this Phosphor G. So really briefly in one slide, AddressCloud provides geocoding and risk intelligence for businesses around the world, primarily in the financial sector. And we work with a lot of insurers so that we can tell insurers how risky a property may be for underwriting purposes. That's one of our key markets, and then we also work with commercial markets with, for deliveries and logistics. So today I'm going to focus on the use case of risk profiling. So this is our Maps application, and in this scenario, an insurer has dropped a pin on the map and has turned some information on that we have from a data vendor about flooding and flood severity, and we can see that this location, which doesn't have an address, it's a greenfield site. So we know where it is geographically, but we haven't got an address attached to that location. That location has a really high flood risk, so we can see it's got a really, really high flood score. So an insurer will be very unlikely to want to write that location. Now, of course, we've got awesome data from our data providers about flooding, about subsidence, about windstorm, about trees nearby, and then intelligence about the building itself. Obviously, that's a large amount of data in our back end, so we need to be able to query that information really very effectively and very, very quickly so that we can tell that insurer in almost no time at all what the risk is like to be at that property. And so all of the processes that we do are API-led, so that's our Maps application, but we have an API that application is built on, but also some of our customers connect to. And the documentation is available, docs.addresscloud.com, if you're interested in the things that we do and the kinds of data sets that we bring together. And so we work with lots of different data partners that have varying data requirements. But obviously, most GIS data comes in one of two flavors, as we all know, vector and raster. And so we have an internal process of taking all of those data sets together and pulling them into our back end, into our service, and then allowing people to query that service for some information. But those data sets are getting bigger because increasingly the resolution of the data sets is improving. We now have digital surface models in the UK down to 5 meters. So that's the resolution of the flood model. I'll talk more about that in a second. And when some of our clients connect to our system, they may be competing in real time against other vendors. So in the UK, we have aggregator websites. So if you go to get your house insurance or your car insurance, you may then go to compare the market, for example, and you see a range of prices that are coming back to you in real time. So when that happens, and an insurer asks us to tell them about the risk at that point in space, we need to be able to respond to them very, very quickly, typically sub 1 second. And that keeps me really busy, because I have to be able to think about how do I do GIS with really big data that's at really good resolutions, but I have to do it really, really, really quickly, and that's my day job. That's what I do. I should also give a kind of really big thanks, because this presentation is an extension of some work that I first presented at GeoMob in London, which is a really great event. I think there's now one in Berlin as well. So if you're in either of those two locations, that's a really nice crowd of people to come and hang out with and talk about geo things. So in the beginning, there was the database, and of course, it was PostGIS, because we all love PostGIS, and PostGIS is awesome. And we, you know, we have a big PostGIS backend to pull all those data sets together and do the spatial analysis that we need. So we had an application an architecture that looks like this. So we have a database, that's where all the data is. We have an application that we've written that combines or queries all that data, and then we have an API or an application at the front. You're sure most people in the room that have done some spatial development will be kind of familiar with this kind of architecture. So this is a bit of an overview of one of the types of data sets that we've got from one of our data providers that does flood data. So they're providing us with this flood model, which is, as I said, at a 5-meter resolution. So it's 24 billion pixels just of the land cover, once you've masked out the other 30 billion pixels that are just the ocean, which obviously we're not bothered about. And the sort of the, if you think from a remote sensing background, you might think about radiometric depths. There's actually 52 different layers of potential information for every pixel in that data set. So it's quite a lot of information. And as I said before, we have quite strict SLAs with lots of our customers where we have to basically provide them that information, but only a subset of it, not the entire data set. We have to be able to query it and say, for this small parcel of land, this is what we can tell you in terms of the flood risk. And so then, that's great, but then what if we want to do other countries like North America? It's like, oh man, like our PostGIS database bill is going to get really big to be able to like scale that, ingesting this stuff with PostGIS raster, being able to query it in real time. I should mention that everything's cached anyway, but we often have use cases where we can't cache because it's a greenfield site, so we don't know in advance what that area, that location is going to be. So what can we do? And at the same time, it's been... put this in because there's lots of talk about what was happening, the future of PostGIS raster and where that was going to go, and it's been factored out into a separate extension. So it was really good to get some updates this morning and see that that project has been factored out, but still kind of core part of PostGIS and is continuing. But for us, it was kind of a time of, well, do we need to look at other solutions? How are we going to make this thing work? And luckily, I was at FOSS4G, and there was a chap called Alex Leith who is here. And I think has just given a presentation who was talking about geopackages and mentioned this thing called COGS. And that was the first time I'd heard of a cloud-optimized geotiff. And I was like, made some notes in my notebook diligently, I thought, and then filed that away. And then a few months later, facing this problem, and I was like, is there some new raster specification? Now, where did I hear about that? Oh, yeah, FOSS4G. So enter the cloud-optimized geotiff. And I'm really pleased that I hope lots of you have been to some of the other cloud-optimized geotiff talks, because there were some brilliant ones that give really good details about how a COG and the TIFF file under the hood works, so that I don't need to cover that information directly myself. But really quickly, you can say, you know, cloud-optimized geotiff is just a way of internally tiling the TIFF information, and it's accessible over the web, so it's a cloud-first data product. So that means you can say, for this bounding box, just give me those pixel values. And for us, that's amazing, because that starts to transform the TIFF file into a queryable, searchable database. If you can say, okay, I want this area, just want this small handful of pixels, I don't need the other 28 billion, just give me the values for those. So, not too much code. I hope that's fairly legible. We can actually use the brilliant Raster.io library that is created by Mapbox to directly interact with our cloud-optimized geotiffs. So I can step you through this. This is the only lines of code that I'm going to show. So we're going to import Raster.io in Python. And then this is the magic. This is where I realized that this thing for us was going to be like gold, because I can put my cloud-optimized geotiff file in what's called an S3 bucket, which is an object store from Amazon Web Services, and I can make a connection to that file in that bucket across the internet, so I don't need my compute to be in the same location as my data store. And then the second bit of magic is I can say, I've got some coordinates, some geographical space, give me the pixel values that fall within that space, and I can do that straight directly to the S3 bucket. Brilliant. Great. Now I've got maybe 10 pixels coming back, which is a very small amount of data. It's happening quite quickly. And I don't need to start to worry about this. I'm not worrying about the size of my my geotiff. One of the other sort of constraints of using PostGIS raster, which is the kind of previous version of this, was that our ETL process was getting longer and longer as our data sets were getting bigger, more data sets, larger areas. more areas of the world. And so that was one of the problems that we faced there. In this version, because the data provider provides a raster data set as a TIFF file, it's actually quite an easy simple process to convert that existing GeoTIFF into a cloud-optimized GeoTIFF. Lastly, I can read those pixels out, and I can send them back to my API, so I can continue the process. Brilliant. So now we've kind of got some pieces on the board in front of us, start to put these things together. We've got our data in a bucket. We can access that. We know that we can pull that through to the API. What are we going to do in the middle? Well, we are address cloud. So everything that we do is in the cloud, is cloud native. Our service this year will be 100% serverless to support our scalability. So the natural choice for us was to use another Amazon Web Services product called AWS Lambda. And Lambda is a piece of technology that allows you to upload some code that you've written that is executed in response to a function and can execute as many of them in parallel as you want, so it's completely scalable. And when that function has finished running, it shuts down, so you only pay for the time that it runs. Typically, you may run that code for maybe 1 to 2 seconds. Fantastic. So we can drop AWS Lambda in the middle. We've got our data store at the back end. The data storage costs of an object store like Amazon S3 mean that even that file, which is many, many gigabytes, doesn't really cost us anything to store. Our AWS Lambda function doesn't really cost us anything to run. And we use another bit of kit from Amazon called API Gateway that provides our API. And that doesn't really cost us anything either for this particular part of the architecture. So all of a sudden, we've gone from what was becoming quite a big challenge, manual process of loading data into PostGIS and then making sure that our PostGIS databases were able to scale with in real time with our users' low latency but high number of connections, into something which scales effortlessly and is very, very cheap, which is great. There is a little bit of learning, there's a bit of a learning curve to get the raster.io package to work in AWS Lambda. Now, thankfully, Mapbox was around again. And they did a blog post, a brilliant blog post, that talked about how to take the raster.io package and some of the underlying bits of GDAL and other bits and basically use a Docker image that's released by Amazon to compile those things from scratch and get rid of a lot of the things that you don't need in there, like the documentation files, get rid of all of that, really slim that thing down. We've got a Lambda layer that means that anyone can get this now and upload that as basically a series of compiled Python files. This is on GitHub. Anyone can start using it with the example that I showed to start playing around. And the service time was brilliant. So we did tests. This is 100 simultaneous requests for different areas of that one really big raster. So those requests are all coming into the service at the same time, and the mean time was 74 milliseconds, and the standard deviation is 20 milliseconds. So we're really happy with that because it means that we can be hitting that service and as much as we want, and it's just going to do that all day. It's just going to keep giving you back those pixels for as long as you want. And so our overall status continued to be the same. We're doing some performance testing at the moment, so I'm excited to see what happens when we start to scale this more than 100 requests. When we continually hit this, maybe like a soak test, where you're doing thousands of requests over a couple of days. We'll be hopefully writing/presenting about that in the future. So I kind of wanted to finish on a bit of a use case to put this in, really kind of give an example, show some maps, I guess. This is a great use case of our application and the stuff that we're doing with COGS. So this is a caravan park, and it's my colleague Mark. It's near where he used to go on holiday when he was a little boy, at the seaside in England. And so if we do a geocode on the address for that caravan park, the postal address where the mail goes is this, the red pin. You can't really see it, but it's the front door, the main office, the building that's bricks and mortar. But the risk to the insurer is obviously all of the caravans across the entire site. So the flood risk for the main building, for the office where the post is delivered, is 1, so very low. I would think about writing that as an insurer. But the insurer is actually insuring all of those caravans. They're doing the site. They're insuring the whole site. So what can we do? Well, we can allow our insurer to come to our Maps application and draw a custom freehand polygon around that site and say, I'm underwriting this, these caravans, or this segment, or the full site. And if we turn on the flood layers, we actually see that that area as a whole has got a very, very high level of potential flooding, and so probably isn't such a good thing to want to underwrite. And we've got that flood score that's come back on the left, that's come back at 30. That is a calculation that's been done by pulling all of the pixels that are in that cloud optimized GeoTIFF and adding the flood score together to get and normalizing it to give you a value. And so that all happens in real time querying, and then we can also visualize that by we actually convert our cloud optimized GeoTIFF into a stylized representation using some vector tiles, so that actually you could turn that on as a layer and you can see, okay, there's a river running through that site. So happily, it was quicker than I expected. I've written a blog post that dives into some of the details about this at blog.addresscloud.com, so you can check that out. And that's it. Thanks for coming. Appreciate it. It's towards the end of the session on the last day. I've had a really good conference, and it was really great to meet all of you, and I hope to meet a few more this afternoon. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Here. Okay.
You previously said that you plan or you moved to Lambda. Is there a reason why you did this? Because it now looks like you are tied to Amazon.
So we were already using Amazon Web Services to deliver our services. So we already using it, so it was made sense for us to use their technology to provide this service. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah? You got another question?
Not really, but yeah. I was curious if you really want to use Amazon, and if you want to move to Google Cloud, for example, I think now it's quite hard for you. So I'm curious why you took this decision.
Because at the time when we started working on not this service, but other services that use the same technology, Amazon was the only solution provider that provided the solution. Vendor lock-in with a cloud provider is an interesting challenge. One of the things that we're doing at the moment is using another piece of tooling called Terraform that allows us to basically infrastructure as code, so we can code out our infrastructure. So that helps because that supports lots of different cloud services backend, but we would have to do, it would be a reasonably major refactor to move some of this stuff over. There's some really great initiatives in that space. There's like open function as a service, and so what I would hope is that over time, we're using AWS Lambda, but that might start to support an open standard, and that we could take advantage of that, yeah. Thanks.
Any other questions?
Sure, yeah.
What's your wish list for the open source geospatial community? What would you like them working on?
Oh, wow. I really wish I'd written a list of things I'd like you all to work on, ready for next year. At the end of a Phosphor G conference. So the question was, what's my wish list for the open source geospatial community? I think cloud-optimized geotiffs and the tooling that's been or is emerging around them, a really good example of thinking about geospatial data in a serverless environment, in a cloud-first environment, and I'd like to see that continue, because the architecture that we have is not, you could not replicate it with a more traditional server-based model. We would not be able to provide the service that we do with the latencies that we have, with the number of users that we have, without an enormously large number of physical machines, and even then, I think it would cause problems. So continuing to talk, and Phosphor G is one such venue, and there's other good conversations going on in the community, both online and in person, about how we continue to move geospatial tech into the cloud, and also how we continue to embrace our open source-ness, our open source ethos, and take that with us and start to challenge some of the things about, well, why can't I run my functions in different cloud providers? Is the underlying technology open?
Any other questions?
Thanks, Mark.
Not
it's not a curveball.
No, not a question as such, just going on to the continuing from what Tom was saying around the vendor lock-in. I've heard that in the past about vendor lock-in. I think, well, there's two things. I think one, I think if you try to be cloud agnostic or multi-cloud, I think you miss the point and you miss most of the benefits you'd get from a particular cloud if you kind of really, really sort of have that layer of a level of abstraction. And then the other thing as well, I don't think you lock yourself in with Lambda. Or you in effect, you simplify your code down to some Python or some JavaScript. And actually, the bits that make it Lambda or Google Functions or Azure are so minimal that actually the rewrite to move from one to the other would be quite small. Mm. And then you can always use things like, we didn't really get on with the serverless framework, but you can use abstractions like Service Framework or Terraform, as Tom mentioned, to kind of take that away. So don't be scared about going all in on one cloud. I think to move to another one would not be a massive, massive issue, I don't think.
Brilliant. It's really hard to see you. It's just bright lights shining down. Wave. Are we done?
One last questions?
One at the back.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you please repeat the question?
Sorry, yes, repeat the question. The question was, there have been lots of talks about big geotiffs and cloud-optimized geotiffs in the browser and tool sets such as geotiff.js that have been presented this week. Do I see an opportunity there to work with that code in the back end? I think that was the question. So firstly, I would say we're not rendering cogs on the client. We're using them as for us, it's a back-end data store and queryable thing. The geotiff.js library does look really good, and it runs in Node, so it could run on the back end. So I'm quite interested to performance test it against the stuff that we've done in Python. The biggest problem that we have at the moment is compatibility to some of the lower-level binaries stuff that's going on in Python and getting that updated. So if that geotiff.js, for example, is a pure JavaScript implementation, so if we could use that instead, that might be really good. So, and in terms of tiling, yeah, I don't know. I've not experimented with looking at stuff on the front end. So, be interesting to see where all that kind of space goes.
Any more questions? We do have time. All right.
The question was for indices or classifications, would they happen on the browser or server side? I think it depends, on the use case. I think there's some brilliant examples of doing stuff on the client. But for us, everything's API-backed, so we need to be able to push out that data, that classification or whatever it is, through our API. So that's why we're interested in, what can we do in the back end? Because we wouldn't want to replicate something where we have one process in our front-end client that's not available through the API. So we're API led, with as many customers using an API as we do having using the front end tooling. So I really think it depends on the use case and what you want to achieve with that data. I think the examples that I've showed here are quite different to some of the other examples. Most examples I've seen with cogs are of RGB imagery, and so that's obviously a completely different use case where we've got a synthetic product that's just using GeoTIFF as a storage mechanism. But it doesn't have to be an image, for example. But that's because it's a continuous surface data product. That's the best way currently to store it. Thanks.
All right, we have more questions. Just give me 1 minute.
Hope you've got your Fitbit on. Then there's steps up.
Sorry, it's wrangler. So my question is, you said you have got the coverage of whole UK. Is it really one image? Is it really a 200 gigabyte cog?
Yep.
Cool.
No, I didn't say that when it first came from the data provider.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay. Yep. And I'm like, oh, here it is.
So that works with the performance you've shown. So that's really impressive and
Yeah. Cool. We just try it out. Oh, that's kind of fast. Yep, that works. Because originally, you know, we'd go into this big ETL process of chopping it up and putting it in. And it seems to be in that backend environment. We do some stuff around caching the connection. So making sure that we've always got that data is always warm, as it's called, so that the access to the data in the bucket and that the code that queries that data is that those things are always ready to go.
Yeah.
That helps quite a lot. I'm really impressed that the whatever the magic is, and I probably have people in the audience to thank that have contributed to that cog specification. The magic that's in there is pretty phenomenal from our perspective. Yeah.
We do have time for one more. For one more question. And I need the exercise, so.
Along the same line as the question the comment that was already asked, do you foresee, like you've got a 200 gigabyte image in there, do you foresee issues with larger images or some sort of performance drop off or something like that, or do you think it would be linear in terms of the performance?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to quote absolute, so I don't know, but I can see that it's probably not going to be scalable to say like North America. So we're gonna we have to start to think about what we do there. But I'd be interested to ask. Well, so for example, I know that the data provider is doing it in North America is doing it on a state basis, so provide you with it, or what you loosely call a region, because I think you. That they would run into problems creating the input data, you know, their output data that we're taking in. They'd have problems creating, getting their flood model to fit within that, you know, continuous surface. So then I think then there's some interesting things about what do we do. Do we take all of those and then tile them? We don't know yet. That's something that we're going to be working on this year. Yeah. Yep. So the question was, Amazon Lambdas have a startup time of 1 or 2 or even longer number of seconds. How do we deal with that? So we're always within SLA. We deal with that by making sure that our internal monitoring service is continuously polling our service to make sure that the sandbox worker, which is the piece of infrastructure that Amazon has that checks out that Lambda code and runs it to make sure that the sandbox worker is always around and kind of listening. And that those can persist for over the course of a day. That same worker would persist, so say Amazon. And so if that thing's always around, then the startup time decreases. And so they have this concept, the terminology is a cold start and a warm start. And so if you... The figures that I show and when our customers connect to us and make a query, they're hitting lambdas which are warm already, so their startup time is drastically reduced.
Thank you, Thomas.
Thanks. Cheers.